Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Well, today is the annual National Day of Prayer. Aside from its constitutional problems and theological presumptions, if I were a praying person, and that's with an A, not an E, I would pray that the Columbia River was finished forever with LNG. And I would pray that FDR's, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, Second Bill of Rights became law of the land, that every American has a right to a job, an adequate wage and decent living, a decent home, medical care, economic protection during sickness, accident, old age, or unemployment, and a good education. Six bills of rights. Some would dismiss these as socialism or products of a nanny state. Call it what you might, these are among the most basic human rights necessary and worth a few prayers by us all. May 4th, this past Tuesday, is the 40th anniversary of the killing of four students at Kent State College in Ohio by the Ohio National Guard. Several others were wounded, some badly. At least one was paralyzed. A nationwide student strike against the invasion of Cambodia by United States and South Vietnamese armies was suddenly galvanized by the deaths of protesting students, two of whom were not among the protesters. Not only at Kent State, 2 days later, today, May 6th, 1970, two black students were shot and killed at Jackson State, Mississippi, by that state's National Guard. Both were young women. Exactly 1 week after the Kent State killings, on Monday, May 11th, 1970, war protesting students at Portland State University here in Oregon were attacked by Portland Police's tactical squad. And I would like to read this morning an account I wrote about that. And to put it into context, I would like to dedicate this reading to anyone and everyone who has been attacked by clubs, guns, gas, or dogs in the past, at present, such as in Greece and Thailand, and recently Iran as well, and in the future, which threatens worldwide disharmony over disparities of wealth and ravaging of resources. And I should probably give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, perhaps, and my opinion only in the entire cosmos. It's not my opinion, perhaps. It's perhaps my opinion only in the cosmos, anywhere and everywhere. But I think not. I call it Bloody Monday. Some of you have probably heard it before. So if you don't want to hear it again, well, there is always KCPB 90.9 in Warrenton, one of our sister stations. One spring afternoon, I stood on a battlefield of a war against a war. I leaned against a stone block that was oblique to where I stood 40 years earlier with about 100 others facing an attacking line of helmeted police who crashed upon us like a Civil War charge on a lovely day in May 1970. That same day was the 178th anniversary of Oregon's Day of Discovery, when the Columbia River was first formally penetrated by white Euro-Americans in 1792. The battlefield was a college campus next to a series of urban park blocks that ran down the center of Portland's southwest side. The ground has changed considerably in the 40 years since Portland police charged our flimsy line of anti-war resistance, and the students leaving their afternoon classes and flowing around me were children, and possibly a few were grandchildren of the young student war protesters I linked arms with to hold the police back. The number of persons crowded into that space that warm spring afternoon outside Portland State University seemed 1,000 at least, shouting, chanting, and screaming as the police, armed with long wood clubs, charged the relatively few of us resisting them, no more than 100. Behind us rose the object of our resistance, a plasticized geodesic dome that had acted as an ersatz hospital for war protesters and street people for the week of our descent. Barricades to block traffic from the streets on either side of the park blocks were built of found objects that included park benches, chicken wire, and wood looted from a few nearby houses being deconstructed for an office building of the college. The demonstration was part of a nationwide shutdown of colleges and universities in protest of the Vietnam War. The protest was dubbed Woodstock Nation from the Rock Festival in upstate New York the previous August. A few days earlier, four white students at Kent State in Ohio had been shot and killed by Ohio National Guardsmen. And a few days after that, two black students, both women, were killed by police at Jackson State in Mississippi. I joined a group of medics at PSU, an ad hoc squad of volunteers formed for the demonstration. Most of us were Vietnam veterans. A few had been combat medics. I had been a USMC reporter-photographer up around the DMZ with infantry and reconnaissance outfits. And in Vietnam, we all went out and got our friends who were hurt. And after my one-year tour, I became a member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. The patch of grass where the hospital tent had been erected provides no clue of that bloody afternoon of May 11th, 1970, to the hundreds of thousands of students, teachers, street people, and others who have walked over it or along the cement paths that now make part of an ex-walkway across the park block, which replaces a street that had been there. I attempted that day to warp back to the afternoon we, who were veterans of it, have always since called Bloody Monday. Cops formed up outside a fenced parking lot. They had arrived in buses, at least 100 of them. We stood across the street at a perimeter we had marked with makeshift barricades to block traffic. I saw several squadrons of blue-helmeted regular cops, but I was looking for white helmets. I saw them, far in the rear, standing as a group. These were the tactical squad, the TACs, as the striking students called them. They had a dual function. They were the city's motorcycle force and its riot control platoon, Portland's version of SWAT. They had been formed to contain black insurrection, but this was the first time they had been ordered out, not against blacks, but against predominantly white college students. The regular cops began to move as a flank. Behind them followed city sanitation workers with shovels and carts. The strikers moved back. I looked over the cops' shoulders. The TAC squad stayed in the background. The flank of blue-helmeted cops halted at the first structure students had built on the grass of the park blocks across the street from the college. They had attempted to symbolically replicate street barricades after removing them from the street earlier in the day. The cops had orders to dismantle the replicas because they were on city property. The sanitation workers started taking the first one down. I stood in the street close to the cops. People gathered on the sidewalk in front of the college. The cops started moving again. The strikers backed up. The line stopped at the next pile of boards, benches, and trash cans. Again, the Department of Sanitation men took apart the ersatz remnant of a barricade, and the line moved on to the next one. The humor of what was happening affected both cops and students. Tensions relaxed. I was still in the street as a group of strikers began parading in front of the nearest cops, walking from curb to curb. The point of touching each curb made them pedestrians rather than marchers without a permit. Jokes and laughter started going both ways. The line moved again, and again the strikers backed up until the cops stopped. The pedestrians started their circular shuffle again, breaking into song. Once more, the line moved after the sanitation men dumped the rubble of the barricade into their carts and stopped at the entrance to a large plastic geodesic dome that we medics had set up as a hospital several days earlier. A police captain told the line to move on. "The hospital stays up," he said with cheerful authority. A fat deputy chief waddled up to the captain. Police officials clustered in a knot around them, joined by college officials and strikers. I stayed in the street, glancing at the large crowd choking the sidewalk. A few minutes later, the police captain emerged from the swelling discussion. "Is the hospital staying up?" I asked. "I don't know," he said cheerlessly. "They're talking about it now. Why can't you tell your cops to keep it up?" "I can't," he said, shaking his head. "I'm not the boss here anymore." I looked at the big white dome that rose above the hundreds of medics. It stood next to an old leafy tree. I saw some of the medics carrying supplies outside. I thought it somewhat ironic that the carefully neutral medic squad might become the cause for trouble, and that the likely fate of our hospital might make its existence necessary. A man with a bullhorn started talking to the strikers. "The police are going to take the hospital down," he said. "We have told them we protest their actions and will stand in front of the dome. The police say they will arrest anyone who obstructs them from taking it down. We have told them we will stand in front linking arms in symbolic protest, and we will not resist arrest." People began to form a half circle in front of the white dome. A woman took the bullhorn. "The city parks department said we could keep the hospital up till tomorrow," she said. "Now they say we're not given permission for it to stay up. I'm pretty damn mad, and I think we should protest their lies." I walked over to a blue-helmeted sergeant. I pointed to the crowd milling around between the police and the gathering crescent of students at the dome. "Do you think any of these people will get hurt?" I asked. He looked at me distastefully past a large, purple-veined nose. "I'm a medic," I said, punching him in the nose with my white armband on which was scrawled a hand-painted red cross. "I want to know if you're going after them or just the people in front of the hospital," I asked. "Nobody gets hurt who stays out of our way," he said. I walked over to the phalanx of protesters and stood in the front rank next to a Japanese woman who lived with a wildly bearded man standing on her left. Her father had spent most of World War II in a desert internment camp. The man with the bullhorn explained that our purpose was symbolic and cautioned us not to resist. "I don't think there will be any arrests," I said to the Japanese woman. "I think they're going to unleash their dogs." "The attack squad? Are you sure?" Her voice was anxious, uncertain that she was committing herself to violence and pain. I nodded and pointed to a mass of white helmets coming up behind the blue helmets. The tactical squad moved up to the line of regular police. "Now watch this," I said. "These guys will turn outboard and split down the middle, and the tacks will come through." It happened just that way, as I had seen it often before. Seeing it now was a collage of the other times. The two ranks of blue helmets marched off, half turning right, the other left. The white helmets pushed forward and stopped directly in front of us and formed a tactical V. A loud gasp rose from the crowd that surrounded us like an amphitheater audience, and a few men and women left us for safety. The rest linked arms and locked elbows. A police lieutenant stepped in front of the tacks. He shouted through a bullhorn, "Disperse or you will be arrested." We began to shout back a mantra of the word, "Peace, peace, peace." The tacks started moving toward us. I was scared. I looked at the woman next to me. She clenched her arm tighter against mine. Barely able to breathe, I stared at the white helmets coming toward us. Each carried a long baton made of hickory wood. They moved in precision like a machine, left foot forward, right foot up, left foot forward, their long, blonde clubs following the rhythm, jabbing at the air with each thrust of left feet. The tacks chanted a karate cry of oos, 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 which rushed forward like surf and crashed against our loud shouts of peace, peace, peace. The cries compressed into a frenzied roar. I realized that I was yelling with the others. I looked around at the people who linked arms, all of us glancing nervously at each other and the approaching white helmets, our shouts louder at each step while the machine chanted its robotic incantation until it was upon us. I watched the man who was going to have me as his target. He was straining forward, his shoulders hunched, his face determinedly blank except for his flapping mouth, his stick thrusting at me with each step. Suddenly, I wanted out, and panic ate through me like an acid. Then the cop was hitting me. "God damn you," I yelled into his face, his eyes angry and also frightened like mine, his mouth still chanting, his stick punching me in the stomach. I leaned into him so that he was unable to hit me in the head. My mind was instantly clear, but I was unable to defend myself because my arms were still linked to the two women on either side of me. I pushed against my attacker. He cursed and slammed his elbow into my chest. He tried to club me on the back, but my shoulders broke most of his swing as I struggled to stay immediately in front of him. The line quickly buckled under the impact of the charging police. We toppled en masse, still linked by our elbows. I landed on my back and rolled over, fists clenched, ready for fight or flight. preferring the latter. Then I saw the Japanese woman who had been next to me laying on the ground. She raised her head at the same time the man laying next to her raised his. "Keep your heads down," a cop growled, and rapped both their skulls with his long baton as if he were tapping a xylophone. Some other people stumbled and fell over them. I pushed through the bodies laying in front of her, shouting her name, pulling people out of the way to get to her. Screams and shouts prickled my ears. I heard clubs crunching flesh and bone. I pulled her to me and put her head in my lap. I ducked a club as a cop ran past. She was crying, saying over and over again that she was all right. Blood streamed brightly through her dark hair. I pulled a compress from my jacket pocket and put it on the wound. I told her to keep it in place, clamped another compress, both of which were maxi pads, on her lover's scalp, and moved on, wrapping Kotex or slapping maxi pads on the wounds of others who sat or lay on the ground moaning and crying or quietly stunned. I crawled from body to body as tac squad cops ran amuck above. Sometimes I sprinted, wrapping heads, arms, ribs, damming rivers of blood. The screams got louder, and I heard angry shouts and curses mixed with cries of shock and pain. I saw a man swinging his fists as two cops charged and clubbed him down. I saw a girl fall screaming to the crowd. To the ground, I beg your pardon. I started for her. "Keep your damned head down," a tac squad cop howled, running at me with his club. I rolled away and he was gone. I got to the girl who had fallen and wrapped a Kotex around her head and another around a man who was on the ground writhing in pain, his open mouth gasping hoarse moans. I got up and ran under a forest of swinging hickory to another group laying against the hospital dome. Several cops acted like berserk Vikings, using their batons to beat down the plastic dome. A man ran out, and three tacks pounced on him and beat him to the ground. I dragged him away from their feet, tied a Kotex around his head, and ran on. Once I stumbled in mud. I had a quick glance of a cop raising a crutch over his head. Then he was lost as wrestling bodies cut him off from my view. Later, I learned he was beating a crippled man with his own crutch. I saw one of the medics fall, clubbed as he tried to get to the injured. A man ran at a cop swinging a board. It bounced harmlessly off the white helmet. The man tried for the cop's ribs and was beaten down. I pulled him away from the cops and, with the help of another man, hustled him out of the fight and left him on a sidewalk. The hospital dome was torn apart. Most of us defenders retreated, screaming insults and profanities, throwing rocks and pieces of the dome's rubble at the cops. The tac stood over several injured persons near the dome's shambles, finished with their assault but hungry for more heads. Medics made rushes to get people still on the ground to safety. We got stretchers and rolled people onto them and out from under the tacks. A regular cop stood over a large man who was semi-conscious. "Help me roll him over," I said. He bent over and grabbed the man's legs and we flipped him on his back. "I'll watch him," the cop said. "I won't let those bastards get him," he said angrily of his white helmeted peers. City ambulances came through, sirens shrieking. We shoved as many injured people into them as fit and they raced for whatever hospitals. It was a risk, sending them to hospitals and possible arrest, but there was little else we could do. Too many people were hurt. Our hospital was demolished. I joined the rest of the survivors after the last of the badly injured were evacuated. The white helmets were in formation again. I thought they might make another charge. I saw a tall, dark medic I called John the Baptist. He was thin, pale, with long, dark, flowing hair and beard that framed a pair of fiery, ascetic eyes. Blood dripped from a rag clenched in a fist. His arms were smeared with blood. I looked at my hands and arms and saw they were splotchy red. Blood stained a white sweater I had borrowed from a woman earlier. John walked toward me like the Baptist approaching disciples, unhurried, cool and easy, tall and graceful. He said nothing. There was nothing to say. Just waited with me for whatever would happen next. The screams and shouts were a cataract of frenzy. Rocks and rubble from the dome and dismantled barricades flew toward the cops. So did clumps of mud. The regular cops moved from the flanks and formed up in front of the white helmets, then started forward. They shambled toward us uncertainly, not as anxious to draw blood as the tacks. The crowd moved back, still shouting, but no longer hurling rocks and debris. They seemed to recognize the difference between the two forces, or were unwilling to risk shedding more blood. As the blue helmets shoved us back, the tactical squad marched off in the opposite direction toward a college parking lot. They loaded onto buses and drove off. Then the evacuation of the regular cops began. They did it in platoons, walking in files of two toward several buses surrounded on all sides by howling strikers in the enraged crowd on the sidewalks. Three of us who acted as medics formed a triangle of sorts in between the crowd and the cops in their retreat to the parking lot. John the Baptist and a man we called Shag because of his wild hair and beard walked on either side of the retreating files of cops while I took the center point, each of us close enough to grab for anyone the cops might wish to take along as a souvenir. The blue helmets reached the parking lot. Other blue helmets streamed out of the lot and stood along the fences that bordered two sides. The retreating cops walked in and boarded their buses. People stayed outside the parking lot and screamed at them, a few once more throwing rocks and mud. John needed for me to go back with him to where the last platoon of blue helmets waited for evacuation. On the way, I saw a broken-up barricade that had been occupied by a group called the White Panthers, an angry group of hippie Anglos who had refused to abandon their position. Several hundred people still stood on the sidewalks. They had watched the tactical squad's attack. I saw shock, anger, and fear on their faces. The final two files of regular cops were moving when John and I got to them. We changed direction and did the same as before, Shag emerging into place from the crowd. Ahead, I saw a few more buses on the street outside the parking lot. Gas-masked cops with pepper gas and mace containers stood around them. I stood in the street watching up and down the line for trouble. A police lieutenant stuck his baton in my chest. "Get up on the sidewalk," he shouted over the noise. "I'm a very mean man with this club." "I'm a medic," I said. "Not my kind of medic," he snarled. "You might not think so if you get hurt," I said. He jabbed me again. "Up on the damned sidewalk," he said. "I'm not going to tell you again." I shoved past a few people and stood on the curb. The file of cops nearest to me moved onto a bus. The other file broke off and formed two shorter ranks that faced outboard of each other. Their faces were taut and grim as the crowd, emboldened by the winnowing, shouted louder than ever. Then it was their turn to get aboard a bus. The cops with gas and mace covered them, with a squad ready with batons standing along one side of the bus. The motors slipped into gear and the drivers honked their way through the crowd, turned right, and rumbled off. The covering squad moved back into the parking lot and got into several police cars. They drove out the other side. It was over. For a number of years, wreaths of flowers were placed each May 11th where the police attacked in the park blocks across from PSU. After a while, as the war waned and finally ended, Bloody Monday was generally forgotten. A movie of the attack, The Seventh Day, was made from television news clips, which I understand won a few documentary awards. A TV camera had focused on me as I dashed under clubs and among cops and injured demonstrators. My mother and sister saw the clip that night. My mother had been certain she would see me die on CBS News while I was in Vietnam. Instead, she witnessed me in another form of combat only a few miles from her home, and she averted her eyes, asking my sister over and over, "Has he been hurt yet?" 25 years after Bloody Monday, in 1995, a replica of the hospital dome was built up on its former site, and a silver anniversary commemoration that only a few attended was held inside one of the university buildings. Among the Bloody Monday alumni for the reunion were the former PSU president who had previously been a CIA agent, the police captain who had vainly attempted to keep the peace, and a few of us who had stood in front line that faced the attack squad. That same year, 1995, 20 years after the Vietnam War ended, former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara admitted the Vietnam War was terribly wrong and that the American public was consistently deceived to justify the deaths and maiming of its young sons and daughters, nearly 60,000 killed in action, perhaps 500,000 wounded, as well as the deaths of more than 1 million Vietnamese, Hanoi claimed 3 million, and uncounted Laotians and Cambodians. Viet Cong and NVA, North Vietnamese Army, casualties will probably never be known, though their body counts were grossly exaggerated and used as the principal measure of the war by Americans. The day I stood outside PSU at the place the police had attacked us 40 years earlier, I was unable to find any sign or plaque that a dramatic confrontation between war and peace had taken place. Gnarled old trees covered the park blocks with shade. Fresh spring grass curled over my shoes, where many had fallen to the police clubs. The parking lot where the cops got off and on their buses was gone, replaced by university buildings. Nations revere and create hallowed landmarks out of battlefields of war. Perhaps a place where persons of peace were struck down, opposing war, should also be made a national memorial, a battlefield of or for peace. And that was something I wrote, which I called Bloody Monday, which most of us were in it called Bloody Monday. Now I'd like to read something that my deceased friend Arthur Honeyman wrote. He would have turned 70 on the 10th of May. He was 30 the day before we got attacked on May 11th in 1970. I'd like to read something he wrote. In 1970, I was sort of an instructor at PSU in that, in the summer of 1969, I persuaded Earl McCannell of the Sociology Department to sponsor and hire me to assist him in conducting an experimental class in the fall. With his help, I created and designed the seminar-style class to promote awareness and to open communication about the hitherto taboo subject of the handicapped in society. Although the historian in me recognizes that political and philosophical beliefs cannot be accurately labeled or pinpointed, fortunately, I might add, I consider myself far more radical in 1995, when he wrote this, than I was in 1970. Back then, my agenda was social upheaval at any cost. Today, my personal political and philosophical agenda is strictly pacifistic. Although I'm not a communist, after much consideration, I've come to the conclusion that the political disintegration of the Soviet Union is probably the second greatest tragedy to befall life as we know it since the inception of Western civilization, the first being the development of Western civilization itself. Ah, yes, I am fully aware that I and almost all other disabled individuals couldn't survive longer than a few days without the evolution of technology advanced by Western civilization, much less thrive. And believe me, I am personally eternally grateful for being born into this society in this era. But though I believe that the disintegration marks the end of the most altruistic political entity in history, this is not why I am a radical. Political persons are not so altruistic as individuals who are dedicated to altruism. To make a long, complex story short, genuine radicals are altruists who are willingly involved in the act of placing the welfare of others above the welfare of themselves. Thus, since the phenomenon known as life is valued as the ultimate possession, a true radical would die rather than use violence to achieve goals. Although only a handful of such altruists have achieved such revolutionary success, i.e. Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., it only takes one to prove that it's not beyond the realm of feasibility, just as it took only the formation of a single vestige of existence to transform nothing into everything, declares my atheistic view of the cosmic process. Thus, as a Gandhian, I assert that armed takeover and resistance is not radical, and as an atheist, I divorce myself from faith in divine providence. Thus, I'm bearing the responsibility of my own insignificant role in the cosmic process. Whether or not I live up to my standards of radicalism is another story. And that was by Arthur Honeyman. And this has been Michael McCusker on National Prayer Day, saying if indeed you're going to say any prayers, pray for the better things rather than the things that constantly put us in rack and ruin.